No deadline, no word count, no editor. Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
You know, the hate that my family has gotten, you know, the bullying that they've gotten is completely unacceptable. You know, online phone calls, you know, it's pretty gross to see. You know, my parents are the salt of the earth, and you know, for my parents to get hate like that is, and my brother and sister, it's awful. And you know, I can handle it. You know, I hope people continue to think that of me.
That's Mark Scheifele, the Winnipeg Jets, speaking today. He has said that he will not appeal 4-game suspension that was handed down by the National Hockey League Department of Player Safety, which, all things considered, Stephen Brunt, is probably, it's probably what I thought he'd get. I didn't think they'd go 6 and carry the suspension through to the end of the series if it were to go 7 games. I wasn't buying into the whole idea that it was going to be a 1-game suspension. I just think that was silly, and the result of maybe too many people being too forensic and thinking too much like a hockey player. 4 games, frankly. I mean, this seems about right.
Well, you know, we knew he was going to get 5 or less because it wasn't an in-person hearing. So that kind of took away the Nazem Kadri kind of option on this thing. Mm-hmm. So then you're talking about, where is it going to be between 1 and 5 or 0 and 5? I know there were lots of folks who were saying 2 or 3 because, you know, Shifley's got a impeccably clean record. He's not Kadri. He's not a guy, you know, or Wilson. Although, you know, we can look back what they did with him the last time. But, you know, I hate to give the league credit on discipline or give George Parros credit because they haven't earned a whole lot at times. But I think it's fair, you know. And again, I know folks will say, well, you know, the NHL is the only league where it treats playoff games different than regular season games, and so 4 in the playoffs is really 8 and all of that stuff, and all of the other things that factor into hockey suspensions. But this, you know, this is the NHL. This is how they operate. These are the playoffs. I thought on balance, you know, it's a crippling blow to the Winnipeg Jets. They, you know, they may still win this series. There's no doubt about what it's going to do to them, though, at a position where they're vulnerable anyway, and he's their, you know, the best offensive player. But yeah, I think that shows that they take it seriously. And it also shows that they take into account that he's not a repeat offender. And right. I'm sorry, I can't argue with that, really. We could quibble over a game here or a game there, but to me, I thought they got it just about right.
I think one of the interesting discussions here, and that was Mark Scheifele, by the way, talking about the abuse that his family had been receiving online and apparently through phone calls as well, which is, you know, given the time of year it is, given the sport we're talking about, and it's not surprising. It was my God, Stephen, I got to tell you, I saw a replay of that hit more often in the news channels, frankly, yesterday than I did on a lot of the sports channels as well. I mean, it was a big national story. So the fact that a lot of people would want to weigh in, even if we remove the emotion from it, certainly can't be surprising. But you know, one of the interesting aspects of this suspension, and you touched on it a bit, and I know Elliot Friedman has touched on it as well, and I don't know if we would hear anything from George Parros or Gary Bettman about this, but part of me wondered if the reaction to what Tom Wilson did and the reaction to the NHL's lack of reaction to that, like, I wondered if that didn't in some way not poison the waters for Mark Scheifele. That's not what I'm saying, but I wonder if that didn't in some ways contribute to the fact that anything that happens in these playoffs might be taken a little more seriously than we would normally see.
I don't know. You're not going to, number one, you're not going to hear from Gary Bettman or George Parros about this, so that's not going to happen. They don't, you know, there's not going to be a, they're not going to tell you what their thought process was because they don't do that. No, I think you can almost, like, none of these things happen in a vacuum, obviously. Like, precedent matters, and sometimes the temperature matters, you know, out there around hockey and hockey violence matters. And you're also right that this is one of those ones that leaps way beyond. This is for people who don't watch any hockey and then are watching this, having this fed to them on their evening news or on their social media stream and are you know, being shocked and appalled by it, right? That there's some of that going on and the hand-wringing that goes with it. And again, I'm not discounting, you know, people being upset about headshots. People should be upset about it. But you know what I mean. There does tend to be the horrors of hockey thing in moments like this, especially in a big game.
There are times where you'd like to go to some folks, stick to news.
Well, yeah, I think,
because we get to stick to sports things. Stick to news.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. But I kind of think, I think the compelling argument to make about this is about this one. It's just, you know, it's 2021 and you saw what happened and you know what the league has been working to try and get rid of, the element that they're trying to eliminate from hockey. They'll never completely get rid of it, but it's that exactly that play, right? It is exactly that kind of play where a vulnerable player gets hit in the head and suffers a brain injury. That's period, right? And it's not about Mark Scheifele's state of mind. Punishment is going to be a little bit dictated by what he has or hasn't done in his past. But in terms of, you know, that kind of play, it's textbook. It is exactly what the NHL has said we will not tolerate anymore. And the fact that they would have tolerated it 10 years ago is irrelevant. So
absolutely.
So to me, this is as clear cut. And, you know, anybody else that's saying, well, he should have got this or he should have got that or he shouldn't. That suspension in this context with this player in the playoffs is exactly in line with that sentiment. That's to me.
Yeah, and I keep thinking back to what Habs head coach Dominic Ducharme said, and I still think it is the most accurate description of this. It was useless. That to me is the 100% the most accurate description here. It was a useless play that's cost a player. Well, that's put Jake Evans in harm's way, but it's also cost Mark Scheifele and by extension his team possibly a chance at going on to the, you know, at advancing in the playoffs. I mean, it was a fundamentally useless hit. The puck was going in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
The puck was going in. The die was cast. The result was, you know, the result was in. And that I think, more than anything else, is going to resonate with me when I think of that hit. Because a lot of the other stuff you see, it didn't necessarily, obviously Nazem Kadri, it didn't necessarily serve the purpose, but it was less useless than this. Nothing was going to be changed as a result of this particular play.
No, if he gets there 5 seconds earlier, maybe, but the way it played out, no. And so it seems like a futile kind of extraneous thing at the end of a game that was already lost. Again, I'm not sure if the computer, you know, if our computer brain could process stuff quickly enough if you're Mark Scheifele's case, but I think he was also, you know, angry and frustrated, and he's watching the end of that game play out in front of him and watching the clinching goal go in front of him, and, you know, you would feel like you had to do something, none of which is a justification for what he did. But, and I think the fact that he's not appealing it, like, look, the stuff with his family and all, like, that's appalling that people, you know, are attacking his family or trying to get at.
I know it's appalling, but none of us are surprised.
Well, I'm a little surprised that people would, you know, call his parents and say your son's horrible. I am a little surprised by that. I'd rather his brother and sister. Like, yeah, I am a little surprised by that. I'm disappointed by that. That's not on. And I don't think we should kind of just think of that as the norm, that, you know, if somebody does something in a hockey game, whatever that they do in a hockey game, that their family is immediately open for personal attack, you know, an implied threat, right? Like, that's wrong. It's really wrong. It's, you know, again, maybe that's the state of the universe, but I can still be disappointed in it.
We'll be joined by Ken Wiebe, Winnipeg Jets reporter with Sportsnet at 3:40, and we'll take a look now that the this has happened. We'll take a look at how the Jets will go about replacing him in the lineup. We do know that Paul Stastny was on the ice today for the Jets, but it's considering where the Jets are, both with Paul Stastny and with Pierre-Luc Dubois' sort of disappearance. You know, it's never a good time to lose Mark Scheifele, but boy, down one game to nothing to the Montreal Canadiens with a goaltender who appears as if he is determined to single-handedly win the Stanley Cup. Probably not the comfiest position to be in. Buck Martinez joins us at 4 o'clock. We've got a really, really good baseball series for you this weekend. Three games between the Astros and the Toronto Blue Jays. The Astros pitching well right now, pitching really well right now. Their lineup looks a lot more like the 2019 Astros compared to the 2020 Astros. And the Jays, they're seeing three right-handed pitchers, and they've done pretty well against right-handed pitching lately. Indeed, they've done pretty well against all types of pitching. So, always a good series when those teams meet, and it should continue to be so. Steven, I want to talk a little bit about Mark Shapiro's appearance on Tim and Friends yesterday. And but look, we are getting to that time of the year. Well, it's always trade rumors are always fair game, but once you kind of limp into July, you start looking ahead to, or into June, you start looking ahead to the July trade deadline. Yesterday, and we know this team is four games over 500, five games back the first place. Mark, I thought, was, you know, said pretty clearly yesterday that this organization is going to be aggressive at the trade deadline. Now, you know, one, that's not, doesn't surprise me. Two, you can say you're going to be aggressive, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make deals, because quite frankly, you can be as aggressive mm-hmm. as you want. Sometimes the deals don't happen. But I almost got the sense, and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but I almost got the sense in some ways that we, and Barker pointed this out, we've moved a little bit away, I think, from the, well, don't forget, a couple of years ago we lost 95 games, dot, dot, dot. We seem to have moved off that a little bit, haven't we?
Well,
based on what Ross and Mark have said.
Barker had Marcus Semien being traded, though. I was listening to the show. So
he was, I know what he was, well, when he talked about what does being aggressive mean, does being aggressive mean?
Well, it doesn't mean that.
Trading Marcus Semien for two? Of course not. But I also told him that.
Yeah, I know. But I was listening. I was just thinking about Barker's chances of getting hired as a GM in the next little while. It probably just went down a little bit today. What's aggressive mean? I think it means when Mark Shapiro said they were going to be aggressive in the offseason, and people kind of rolled their eyes, which I'm not sure why they did, because they went out and signed Ryu the offseason before. But, you know, that's Toronto. They rolled their eyes and they went out and got the best position player on the market the last year. So that was pretty darn aggressive. So I wouldn't take it as nothing when he says that, because he's so far has, you know, followed up on his words when he's used that particular word. I think, but you made a good point, Jeff. It takes two, right? Like, you know, deals, and if you look at baseball right now we're still early June, so there's still probably another month before things are fully resolved and where teams are, but there's hardly any, you know, teams that are for sure going to be sellers that are just cleaning out the basement right now. And, you know, everything's available. It's probably 6, 7, 8 of them. You know,
22 of 30 teams going into last night's game were within 5 games of the playoff spot.
Now, sometimes you can be within 6 games of a playoff spot, but you kind of know, right?
Yeah.
But like even a team like the Twins, who've had an awful start, right? They've been terrible, but they went into this season thinking they're a playoff team. At what point do you white flag the Minnesota Twins this year? You know, realistically, you look at their record and you say, well, no team, you know, almost no team that's had their record at this point in the season has been a playoff team. But, you know, are they quitting now? Are the Washington Nationals quitting now? You know, probably not. But 3 weeks from now, they might be forced to. So, you know, beyond that, though, you're looking, you know, again, at a handful of teams that are sellers and a whole bunch of teams that are, you know, some teams that are buyers for sure, a bunch of teams that are buyers maybe, and a very tiny number of teams that are sellers, which means that, you know, like if you're Detroit trying to get to and you're ready to move Matthew Boyd, and, you know, Matthew Boyd's had, you know, kind of an iffy season, but look at the starters that are available. He's, you know, then you're probably going to have a bunch of phone calls on him. You know, if you're trying to move Kendall Graveman, you know, who's suddenly, you know, has gone from being a mediocre starter to a really good closer, you're going to get a million calls, and you know, because everybody needs a guy like him. And you know, so that's you know, so when you talk about deals, you know, would the Jays like to get Kendall Graveman? He'd look really good right now, and he even played for them. He's even their own guy. He came out of their own system. But what's the cost going to be? Well, the cost is going to be what the market will bear.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a vigorous market right now by the looks of things. You know, I think we kicked around yesterday the name Daniel Hudson, you know, a guy like that. What's, you know, if the Nationals are out on this season, there's a guy, and they, again, guy who played for them, did well. They wheeled him in a deal, did well. But a guy like that is useful to almost every one of those teams that considers itself a contender. You know, it's in some ways it's easier if you've got to just go out and try and find a third baseman, because not everybody needs a third baseman. You know, pitching's tough.
Yeah, I tend to look at the move that the Rays made, the early move they made, getting Fireisen and Rasmussen, and again, I to me, that's the type of move that's aggressive because of the time it was made. Now, understand as well that there aren't a lot of organizations that have the type of depth that shortstop that they can trade their everyday shortstop. But my point is, I think a lot of people are looking at the Jays as adding another, you know, somebody capable being a number two starter, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're more likely to see them do some sort of move that brings in a couple of arms that can be used, because I understand that Julian Merriweather will come off the IL at some point. We don't know what's up with Ryan Barucki. Nobody seems to, if they do know, they're not telling us that. I think at some point, if you're the Blue Jays, you'd like as much certainty as you can get with those arms.
Yeah.
And God knows there's not a lot of certainty with bullpen arms, right? It is a fungible asset. But that, to me, is the type of deal you would see being made.
Yeah, I think Danny mentioned, you know, the Phelps deal that they made when they originally acquired Phelps. Like, that's that kind of guy. You know, now when they got Hudson, they picked him off the waiver wire. There's not going to be a lot of gems on the waiver wire at this stage, but. I think a couple of those kind of guys is way more likely than a front of the rotation starter. And if it's a back of the rotation starter, I'm not sure it helps you that much. So, you know, unless, look, if Max Scherzer falls in their lap, you know, and the Nationals are out and they really love something that the Jays would part with. Yeah. But if you look at it right now, like, what does a fifth starter make a huge difference to this team? And again, I'm not saying I'm not, you know, entirely counting on what you've got from Ray and Matt so far, but you know, we're not, this is in April now. So, you know, it would have to be, you know, a depth starter. Sure. Cause somebody could get hurt, but a couple of guys in the bullpen could stabilize that bullpen pretty quickly.
Yep. Somebody that can, preferably at least one guy who can pitch and leverage in leverage situations. And then if Julian Merriweather does come back,
it's a bonus, right?
A bonus, exactly. Or and if Nate Pearson does come up and goes in the rotation and somebody else moves in the bullpen, it's a bonus again. But one thing we've seen this year, it's a pretty safe bet to say that if the Blue Jays are going to make the playoffs this year, they're going to need another couple of bullpen arms here.
It would, like, it sure help. Now, the one thing, it is worth keeping in mind, they got about 10 more days where the schedule's still pretty rough if you look at it, right? They've got another one of these stretches coming up where you think, don't they play anybody who's not really good? Right. But then they play the Orioles, like, every other day for 2 months, right? Like they're playing the Orioles
like
in the Mariners.
Spring training.
Yeah. So, and they get some teams, you know, if you look at their schedule, it's interesting. They get some teams at the end of the season who might well be gone and out of it.
Minnesota?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I, like, the schedule plays to their advantage after the middle of June.
Oh, it hugely, hugely to their advantage. I do believe now, I checked before. I checked coming out of Monday. They either had the toughest or second toughest schedule in terms of opponents' winning percentage going into the last series. And you know, you're right. It's still, there's still some heavy lifting to do here before you get to,
so
to
they,
some of the
yeah.
Cookies.
So, but they're going to have to dine out on, like, when, you know, the Orioles are. It's not where you start saying, well, if we win 3 out of 5, that's fine, right? You're going to have to roll them. And you're going to have to do that when you get the Mariners, and you're going to have to, you know, if the Twins are still like this when you get them, you know, but there's, like that said, Jeff, the way, you know, there's no reason to believe that they can't do that. They're good enough, and they're going to get better when Springer comes back.
So as we mentioned, the Major League Baseball trade deadline isn't until the end of July. But June is a time where teams start to call other teams. Reach out calls, as they're called. Kevin Goldstein has done that. He's a former special assistant to the general manager, director of player personnel at the Houston Astros. He's made those calls at this time of the year. So we're going to talk to Kevin Goldstein about the process of establishing needs, or the process, I should say, of communicating needs and availability to other teams. How do teams actually go about doing that? Kevin Goldstein's now with FanGraphs. We'll talk to him about that. We'll talk to him about baseball's crackdown on substances. And we'll talk to him on some of the love that he's given to Blue Jays catching prospect Gabriel Moreno as well. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Joined at 425 by Kyle Bukauskas, ringside host and reporter with Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada, ahead of tonight's game between the Winnipeg Jets and the Montreal Canadiens. What are you expecting in that game, Brent? You expecting any sort of, Mark Scheifele's been suspended. Are you expecting any sort of nonsense?
No.
Out of the start, or do you think everybody's kind of moved on?
I think if you're Ducharme and you're Montreal Canadiens, you're rolling, man. Like, why would you?
Yeah.
You go win another hockey game, right?
Exactly.
You've won four in a row. You won that one, not comfortably, but comfortably. You got a chance to go to the final four, and no, I don't think you need a line brawl. Like, if and when Scheifele steps back on the ice in this series, again, we talked about this, they'll go through the ritual. Yeah. But I think right now it's about winning hockey games. And if you're the Habs, boy, like think of where they are now compared to where, you know, they were all season, or even where they were entering the playoffs. They are now the odds-on favorite to win this series.
Yeah, I think that's pretty safe to say. And I mean, I also happen to think you're right that I'm not saying there won't be perhaps a nastier tone to this game,
maybe
especially at the beginning. And that may be in the part of the Winnipeg Jets trying to send out a quote-unquote message because they lost game one in their own arena. But, I'm with you. If I'm the Montreal Canadiens, I'm going into that game. All I'm thinking of, we're going to be up 2-0.
Yeah.
not only could we win this series, but if you go up 2-0, you've got at least the idea of sweeping at home has got to at least enter your It's got to at least be in the back of your head someplace.
Yeah, going home, some fans there, you know, all that stuff. But they're playing with enormous degree of confidence right now. And, yeah, why would you give, you know, do you want to give these guys a cheap power play or two early on? Like, don't give them any oxygen. Like, that'd be crazy.
Absolutely. Don't poke the bear. We talked about the Toronto Blue Jays and what they may do at the trade deadline, largely because Mark Shapiro, president and CEO of the team, was on Tim and Friends yesterday, and it was, as you would expect, was asked about team's needs, and he suggested the team would be aggressive at the trade deadline, and I don't think it certainly surprised anybody, but it's kind of cool to initiate those discussions right away in the media, and it kind of got me wondering, okay. We all know about the trade deadline, but I don't imagine that there's a major league team out there that decides a week before the trade deadline, okay, let's start making calls. Or maybe there are. I don't know. But I don't think most successful teams view it that way. Kevin Goldstein is a staff writer at FanGraphs. He's also a former special assistant to the GM player personnel with the Houston Astros. He's made these calls, and he wrote about it in his latest piece in FanGraphs, so I wanted to get Kevin on. Kevin, thank you so much for joining Stephen Brunt and myself. This is, you know, the trades fascinate me, not just who ends up going where for whom, but the whole nuts and bolts of how a trade, you know, how that seed gets planted, how and when it gets watered, who looks after the watering, and then when it finally blooms into a deal. So tell us a little bit about reach out calls, if you could.
Hey, you know, it's June, so it's reach out call season, and this is what every team really starts to do, which is,
you assess where you are, and sometimes you're ready to say I'm a seller or a buyer, and sometimes you're still on the bubble, which I think is the case for probably about a third team in baseball. But if you're going to be a buyer or a seller, it's time to, you know, be a little proactive, and you get together with your group, you decide what your messaging is going to be, and you start assigning these reach-out calls. And sometimes it's GM to GM, sometimes it's people calling assistant GMs, but it's more just like making initial contact. Hey, this is what we're looking for, or this is what we're looking to deal, and this is what we're looking for back, and just to start to plant those seeds for what's going to happen. And, you know, we all read MLB trade rumors. They do a tremendous job. We also probably know about 10% of what's happening, and it's a lot of work for, you know, it's really everything feels like a lottery ticket at times. You know, for every 100 talks that get initiated, you know, maybe 10 become real conversations. For every 10 of those real conversations, you maybe get one over the line. So it's a lot of work goes in, and you know, it's fun to this day. I can look at any roster. I can look at a Blue Jays roster, and obviously when I was with the Astros, they got a lot of deals done with the Blue Jays. And I could think of, you know, at some point talking about nearly every player on the roster. And sometimes it was an immediate shutdown, and other times it went somewhere. But, you know, now's the time to start figuring out what you need, starting to identify those targets, and starting to reach out to these teams and telling them what you're looking for.
Kevin, what goes into the decision, you know, the decision to sell or not for teams? Like, look, you know, Baltimore's bad. They knew they would be bad. They will be a seller. There's no shock there. Minnesota is bad. They thought they would be good. How does, you know, the calculation of what you're, you know, when you're going to make that pivot and decide, okay, this, we're going to white flag this season. We are going to try and bring back assets for assets. Like it's got to be, you know, part of it's obvious, but part of it seems, you know, is not so obvious. You know, are the Washington, now what would it take for the Washington Nationals to be a seller this season?
Right. It's a really good question. And you talked about teams that are kind of obvious, like the Orioles. And, you know, if you're the Twins, it's a great point. I mean, the Twins, I'm sure, on April 1st, up they're going to compete for the Central Division. They're sitting here at 22-34 and 12 games out. And, you know, I'm sure that they want to give this another month. I'm sure they want to see if they can get hot. They feel good about the roster and want to see if they can get back in it. But if not, it's going to be time to move guys. And there's going to be certainly a market for guys like Nelson Cruz. I think the Nationals are maybe in a little different situation where they're only six out in a really bad division. And they feel like they can get hot. But at the same time, you do have to balance that with the fact that they have Max Scherzer. If Max Scherzer goes on the market, they have the number one pitching target for the trade deadline, period. And that should be able to generate a pretty nice return. There's some complications because Max will have 10-5 status and can kind of define where he gets traded. But no matter where he goes, they're going to get real players in return. It's the kind of thing that can kind of, you know, kickstart your next steps into contention. So, you know, for some teams, like you said, it's real obvious. If you're, you know, a first-place team or close, you're going to go for it. I think the most fascinating team in all of this might be the San Francisco Giants. Mm-hmm. You know, the San Francisco Giants have the best record in baseball. They've surprised everybody, but they're sitting there in the same division with these two behemoths in the Dodgers and the Padres. They might only be playing for the wild card game, which is, you know, really is a coin flip. So it's kind of a 50-50 chance of getting into, you know, quote-unquote, the real playoffs. And their entire team's free agents next year, basically. You know, no matter how, if they go for it or they don't go for it, they are rebuilding next year. So do you want to kind of kickstart that and figure out what you can get for Kevin Gausman, who, if Scherzer's not available, becomes the best pitcher on the market? You know, the guys like Brandon Crawford, Brandon Belt, their entire rotation, guys who've been good, Dee Sclafani, Wood, all these guys are free agents next year. You could really add a lot of depth to that system, or you can go for it and just delay the rebuild, which is inevitable because you're losing so many players.
Kevin, I'm wondering, when teams sit down to start this process, how much of the decision as to who initiates discussions with which team are based on personal relationships? You know, you'd often wonder that, because you do notice, right, there's some GMs that make more deals with certain GMs, and maybe it was more the case before than it is now. But how much do interpersonal relationships count when you're starting to, again, plant the seeds of a deal?
Quite a bit. It really means a lot. And you know, when I was with the Astros, the team really split up amongst three or four people. And I generally did 6 to 10 of these and took care of 6 to 10 of the teams. And it was all with people who I had really good relationships with, people I knew and, you know, could have a frank conversation with. And you might sit back and go, yeah, someone might say, hey, I know Mark really well, we'll call Mark. Someone might say, I know Ross Atkins really well, I'll call Ross. And it really works out that way, that that kind of initial conversation is one that you want to have between two people who know each other well, who can trust each other. And it really is a time. There's no time for subterfuge or trying to trick anybody here. It's really a time for honesty. And look, this is exactly what we're looking for. This is what we need. You know, these are the prospects we might be willing to move. And these are the prospects who really would be tough for us to do anything with. This is kind of the no-go area. And that's really what you try to do is try to get this thing going in the right direction. And that happens with like a good, honest conversation with someone you know well.
Kevin, when you look at the Jays right now and where they are in this, that spectrum of sellers, buyers, they've got a winning record in a very good division. They played a very tough schedule so far. They have the usual assortment of injuries that everybody in baseball does this year. But it's kind of hard in terms of their big picture timetable. Maybe this is a year. Maybe next year's the year. When you kind of look at them heading towards this deadline, Mark Shapiro has said they're going to be aggressive. You can define that in a lot of different ways. But, how aggressive would you think a team in their position would be? And, again, what they're going to be looking for is pitching. That market is going to be red hot no matter what.
You're right. It is going to be pitching. And it's interesting because, I think they should obviously feel pretty good about the front of the rotation. But the 4 and 5 spots have been shaky at best, let's just say. And it's now you're in this weird position where you might just want to shore up the rotation with the back end and end up getting some pitchers who might help get you to the playoffs but aren't going to be a big factor in a playoff series. And that kind of player might cost a little less. He's not necessarily helping you with your chances in October. He's just helping you get to October. You got to get to a point where those number 4 and number 5 spots in the rotation are games you feel better about getting a W in. I do think they should try to address catcher. It's a really hard thing to do mid-season. But you guys know this. Finding a catcher for the Blue Jays has been a struggle for a few years now. It just doesn't seem like anyone can do it. And I do think they need to kind of sit around and say, our biggest acquisition for the second half is already here, and that's George Springer. He's only played 4 games all year. This is a guy who's going to upgrade us really in multiple positions. Because I think, once he returns, obviously he's a superstar level player, but he also allows you to kind of flex your DH. And I think you'll see them doing this and giving their other outfielders an upgrade. So it upgrades you both in the outfield and at designated hitter and really changes the entire dimension of the lineup for you in that situation. But I do think the focus is going to be on finding someone, maybe make a real run at someone who's starting a playoff game for you, but have a backup plan of just finding someone who can kind of reinforce and add some depth to that rotation.
You talked about the catching situation, and those of us who watch the team would agree wholeheartedly with you on that. There is it is considered to be a quote unquote area of organizational depth, and of course a lot of people got excited about Alejandro Kirk. But I'm interested in particular about Gabriel Moreno, because since he got here, I've had people in the organization just rave about this guy. No surprise, he's a pretty highly touted prospect. But you give him a lot of love in your sort of low hype prospects who are getting close to the majors. What do you think would separate him from the other guys kind of in the pack there, other Blue Jays catching prospects?
Sure. I saw Gabriel. I live in the Midwest, and I saw Gabriel in 2019 during his season at Lansing, and it was just really impressed. And it's just a really impressive combination, something you don't see, especially in today's game where guys talk about 3 true outcomes all the time. This is a guy who has a real feel for contact. He's a low strikeout hitter. It's not big power, but it's what I would refer to as sneaky pop. If you make a mistake, he is going to hit it hard and hit it over the fence. He's a little on the small side, but he's an athletic backstop. He throws well. He kind of checks a lot of boxes. His approach has really improved this year at AA. I think this guy might just be an everyday catcher. I'm not sure I'm ready to throw him to the Wolves in Toronto or I guess Buffalo right now. But, you're talking about a very young kid. He's just 21 years old. He has somewhere over 700 plate appearances as a pro. This is not a finished product, but I think he's the best of the young catchers. And I think he's a real prospect as a possible everyday guy.
Now, this happened actually after we sort of reached out to you to come on. There's a lot of talk, obviously, now in baseball coming out of that owners' meeting about enforcing some of the pre-existing rules or at least paying closer attention to the use of illegal substances, foreign substances by pitchers. Now, we know that part of the analytical bent of this game has been, you know, has been an infatuation with spin rate for obvious reasons. Just, I'm wondering if you think this focus on substances could have some sort of an impact on the trade deadline. Because, in other words, our team's going to be skeptical. They see a guy with a high spin rate. They go, that looks pretty good, but why exactly is that spin rate what it is? Do you think this could kind of add a wrinkle to things here?
It could. You know, I think what you end up doing is you kind of dig a little deeper and you go, oh, this guy's, you know, spinning the heck out of the ball. Let's see if he was spinning the heck out of the ball a year ago. Let's see if he was spinning the heck out of the ball 2 years ago. Has there been some sort of sudden change that would make us wonder why he's spinning the heck out of the ball if it's a sudden thing for this pitcher? And I think those are the kind of things that are going to come up. But, you know, to be honest with you, those are the kind of things that really come up in front offices anytime there's any sort of strange performance change. And obviously for a while in the previous decade, players would do strange and amazing things. And all of a sudden people go, do you know anything about this guy on the juice? You know, there's all sorts of cheating has been going on for a century, and there's going to be things where that's going to get talked about. I do think it'll come up. You know, there are pitchers who have had remarkable jumps in their spin rate, and I do think those pitchers are going to be looked at a little closer, and it'll be interesting to see how that, you know, how teams deal with it, how they deal with scouting those players, both in person and on video. I think it's the kind of thing where in person scouting becomes really important because you can watch that pitcher for 3 hours. You can just stare at the pitcher. You're not at the mercy of the camera angles and the directors. You can stare at that pitcher. You can watch what he does with his hat. You can watch if he's sticking his thumb in his belt, et cetera, et cetera. And we see it all the time. And, you know, I really think this is something, you know, on some level, pitchers are using some sort of substance. I would guess somewhere between 2/3 and 3/4 of them. So this is not an isolated thing where you maybe have one or two guys on your staff. This is where the overwhelming majority of your staff is using it. And I do think teams are going to take some time to maybe figure it out, but obviously they're also going to take some time to see if MLB is really enforcing this or not, or if it's just word.
Kevin, really good of you to join us today. Terrific insight. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. Have a good weekend, guys.
Take care.
Thanks,
Kevin. Kevin Goldstein, writer at Fangraphs, former special assistant to the GM, player personnel at the Houston Astros. A lot of really good insight there.
So we have a Blue Jay trade to report.
Oh, yes.
Here, I should do the ticker tape sound. Yeah. Then this is a kind of, it's a nothing trade, but there's our breaking news music. Yeah, that's what we need. Given all our conversation about arms and bullpens and stuff, they just sold Ty Tice to the Atlanta Braves for cash considerations. Ty Tice we saw very briefly this year, right, with the Jays, but he's mostly been a Triple A. But he's 24. He's had some success at Triple A. He's a guy they drafted, this administration drafted, and cash considerations. I never know entirely what that means, but it's not a player. So yeah, what do you make of a weird? I know this is completely inconsequential deal, but it does.
To make anything out of it.
Well, but why? It is interesting that you would give away, you know, an arm for cash at this stage of the season when all we talk about is a guy who you actually cycled through your bullpen at one point this year.
That could be. It's not very good.
Well, maybe 24. You've got time, you know. But it's not. You know, it's not like he's 28.
Yeah.
So it's I mean, it's, obviously they're not that thrilled about him, but. He is their guy.
You know, cash is king, my friend.
Cash is king. Yeah. I'd love to know what that really means.
Ken Wiebe covers the Winnipeg Jets for Sportsnet. What do you think we're going to talk to him about today? He'll join us next. This is Writer's Block. Well, the Montreal Canadiens will look to go up 2-0 on my Winnipeg Jets tonight. I don't know what my level of confidence is right now going into this particular game, Mr. Brunt. I'm a little concerned as to how the Jetties will react to not just not having Mark Scheifele, but just the whole thing around. You know, because I was thinking about this this morning. This is a team that blew the doors off the Oilers. They've got to be feeling pretty cocky, pretty confident. They've kind of sat back, had time to watch the Habs and the Leafs play and feel really good about themselves. And then all of a sudden, all hell breaks. It was like just emotionally, this is losing the game, you know, losing a couple of guys to injury, one of them, Mark Scheifele. They hit the fallout. That's kind of a big emotional slap in the face to a team that's been kind of futzing around for a couple of days.
Start a series at home, lose the first game, have the other guy's goalie outplay your goalie because goalies are going to be a big topic of a conversation, and then lose your best player for four games on a suspension, where everybody's angry. Like if adversity, makes champions. This will be the great turning point, and they'll find resources they didn't know they had, and Connor Hellebuck will stone the Habs, and they'll win the series despite everything going against them. And they were a better team than Montreal during the regular season, so it's not a, it wouldn't be a crazy upset, but that's a lot. That's a big pivot in game one of a seven best of seven series.
That's exactly what's going to happen, isn't it, Ken Wiebe?
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I think if Connor Hellebuck has his way, that's exactly what's going to happen. But certainly an interesting several days here. There's no doubt about that. And everyone's wondering what the reaction will be on so many fronts, right? How do the Jets respond? How do the Canadians respond? Is there some thought of retribution? Does that go by the wayside? Stiffness of the suspension? What does this game look like? I mean, it's certainly going to be an emotionally charged atmosphere. And I'm not quite sure how it's going to look, but I think the Jets will happily embrace the underdog mentality. It kind of suits them. Yes, they entered the series as a slight favorite, but I would say the deck is certainly stacked against them after the recent series of events.
I think I know the answer to this question already, Ken, but I'll ask you still. The reaction in Winnipeg to the Scheifele suspension, to the four games, just how that went down with the fans there.
Yeah, the blood was boiling quite heavily. The temperature got quite heated. You guys have seen it, so whether it's social media or other platforms, it's quite out of control. But one of the things that I reminded many of those same people who were up in arms, yes, Mark Scheifele has a very squeaky clean history, but if the roles are reversed and it's Jake Evans or heaven forbid, Corey Perry delivering that same type of check on Mark Scheifele and it knocks him out of the series, I think those same people that are calling the suspension too long think that four games is probably not enough. We know the Jets were saying, it depends on what Paul Maurice had a great quote again, right? The your opinion of the hit probably depends on which flag you're flying on your car. I think this was a very, excellent hockey player who his route started out most definitely as I have to beat Jake Evans to the far post, but although he suggested he was only trying to negate the goal, I think that, the ability to have the sober second thought process may have been slightly different than what we saw in the video evidence. But again, the one thing that stood out today, guys, to all of us, unfortunate the outcry and the unnecessary online bullying and ridiculous behavior directed at Mark's family. I mean, that's just something that is unnecessary and completely ridiculous.
How do the Jets go about accounting for his absence in terms of the lineup? Now, I think you reported Paul Stastny on the ice this morning, and what are the expectations there? I mean, the best thing that could happen, frankly, is for Pierre-Luc Dubois to come off the milk carton, right, and resurface. That would probably be the best thing.
I would say so. Yes, guys. Paul Stastny did skate this morning. Again, it's hard to say if it was gingerly or not. I would say he's 50-50 for tonight, and if he can't play, obviously that's another blow. Andrew Kopp would just move into the middle, but yes, Pierre-Luc Dubois, the microscope is most definitely on. It has been all year long, and this is a chance for him to leave his fingerprints all over the series. He's been used in more of a complimentary role, but I think it's pretty safe to say the Jets can't survive the series without him making a big impact. And the other thing, too, I mean, it seems minor to folks in the outside world, but losing Dylan DeMello 29 seconds into this series to a quote-unquote soft tissue-ish injury that Kevin Bieksa believes could be a high ankle sprain, that's a massive blow. DeMello and Josh Morrissey were outstanding in the first round, and it totally changed the complexion of their back end. But back to Dubois, he needs to be a force. He had a pretty quiet game one up until the point where he had the assist on the Forbert goal. He needs to impose himself physically and then get going and contribute a little bit of offense as well, because yes, the Jets have center depth, but They're going to need to rely on guys like Dubois to help pick up the slack. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, no, and I think the DiBello point is said, like, I've heard a couple guys talk about this already, and it's, Ken, that just, like, I'm not saying it's the equivalent of losing Shifley, but given that it's not an area of strength and depth, it in terms of how this game plays out, it may have nearly the same kind of impact, right?
Yeah, I mean, as strange as that may sound to some folks who don't know Dylan DeMello, he's just the kind of guy who is a safety valve and makes his partner better. And he was a real stabilizing force. Josh Morrissey, outwardly speaking, candidly about how big an impact it was having him back as his partner. He'll in some ways have to carry his pairing, if you will, now that he'll be, unless he's going to play with Pionk. The Jets may end up loading up Pionk and Morrissey together and putting their two best defensemen who are left healthy together, and then you're kind of rolling the dice with the other four guys. But I mean, this is one of the reasons, I know we talked about the deadline a lot. Jordy Benn was a guy brought in as an insurance policy. Well, now you got to try to cash in on that insurance policy here. I think he'll be in, and if it doesn't work out for Jordy, then Billy Hainala would be the in case of emergency break glass kind of candidate there. So it'll be interesting to see how the back end holds up, but obviously Hellebuck is going to need to stand tall. And another guy we've talked about all year, Jeff, the impact Nikolaj Ehlers has had. I think right. This is a massive opportunity for Ehlers to not show that it's his team, but it's a big opportunity on a big stage. This is a guy who loves the spotlight. He's usually getting those secondary minutes, but with Shifley out, he's probably going to be on the first power play unit. His ice time will be on the rise. And he kind of had a quietish game one until he made that exceptional cross-ice pass to Kyle Connor. And he's a guy who's often very critical of himself. And I expect that he's one of those guys that's going to step up and know that he needs to provide some of that offensive spark and really be an on-ice leader for this team going into game two.
Ken, really good of you to do this today. I know it's a hectic day for you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Always good to talk to you guys. Enjoy the game and have a great weekend.
You too. That's Ken Wiebe, covers the Jets for Sportsnet. You can follow him on Twitter at Wiebe's World. He and Sean Reynolds do a terrific job covering the Jets, mm-hmm. and they're all over the place, social media, podcasts, etc., etc. And yeah, I again, you know, boy, Pierre-Luc Dubois kind of made his bones in the bubble mm-hmm. Last year in that series against Toronto, and he's the guy right now the Jets need.
Like, be good, be good. If that guy shows that, yeah, this would be the time for him to turn up because that guy has been nowhere to be seen since he got out of quarantine.
Absolutely. Buck Martinez is our Blue Jays play-by-play voice on Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan. An intriguing series this weekend in Buffalo. The Houston Astros, the Toronto Blue Jays, two teams that are pitching well, two teams that are hitting well, two teams with some bullpen issues. So what will this series come down to? We'll ask Buck Martinez about it. This is Writer's Block.
Writer's Block with Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt, and Richard Deitch on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
I understand that a lot of you out there probably spend a great deal of time watching hockey, especially if you're a Maple Leafs fan. The past couple of months, you probably paid a little bit of attention to the Blue Jays. You caught them out of the corner of your eye. You're probably aware that they're four games over 500, that George Springer hasn't played much. Probably aware of the issues surrounding the team and Tampa Bay's on a roll and they're five up and all that good stuff. I wonder how many people, though, will be tuning into tonight's game between the Blue Jays and the Houston Astros and take a look at the 31-25 Astros and look at some of the offensive numbers and say to themselves, the hell's happened to this team? I mean, this 2021 Astros team looks a lot more like the 2019 Astros team than the 2020 Astros team. And if you look at the numbers and do a deeper dive into some of their underlying statistics, you find that the core players on this team, the Correas, the Bregmans, the Altuves, are actually inching closer to being the type of team they were in 18 and 19 than the type of team they were last year. Significant, I think, considering the fact they're doing it. Well, They're doing it without George Springer. Buck Martinez is our Blue Jays play-by-play voice on Sportsnet. He joins us on Writer's Block to look ahead to this series. Buck, as always, Stephen and myself appreciate your time. It is kind of interesting, isn't it, when you look at this team and you look at everything it's gone through, and you know, we had Jeff Blum on Baseball Central, their color analyst, and he said, guys, it really does kind of look a lot more like 2018 and 2019.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a real surprise when you think of the caliber of the players that you just mentioned. When you have Correa and you have Altuve and you've got Kyle Tucker, a young prospect that's coming on, Yordan Alvarez, I mean, they've got a good team. Last year's 60 games, and, you know, here we are. What have the Blue Jays played now? They've played 60 games. They haven't played that many. They've played 54 games. So, you know, they're inching closer to that 60-game plateau. So Marcus Semien just had a Zoom call, and he talked about that, and they said, well, what happened last year? He said, as we have just seen this year, you can go from one bad month to one great month, and all of a sudden your season turns around. Right now, if we were last year, the season would be over in six more games. So I think that's what happened to the Astros. And I think that even Semien said, you know, last year, as bad as my year was, my stroke came around in the postseason, and I had a good postseason. So it's about a 162-game schedule. I think that's what we're seeing with the Astros. Good players at the end of 6 months are going to be who they've been for most of their career.
Yeah, that makes sense. Buck, every time I watch a Jays game, I see George Springer in the dugout, kibitzing with the guys. Every day I expect to see a notice on my phone saying they've sent him out for a rehab assignment to Trenton, and which would start the countdown. And it does. This is a very measured recovery from a hamstring, from a quad. Do you have any sense of where we are in this? Has anybody said anything in the Zoom calls to indicate what the timeline is at this point?
Absolutely not.
Wow.
And I'm as baffled as you are by this. You know, he had an oblique injury late in the spring. He aggravated a quad. He played four games, re-aggravated that quad. And here it is, the 4th of June, and he's played four games. I don't know what the explanation is. And, you know, now it's on player because, you know, the player is the only one that could say, okay, I'm ready to go. But we have seen him in Buffalo. He's there again today, and he's going to the regular workout. Since they've been to Buffalo, I've seen him run the bases. I've seen him field fly balls in center and right. And I've seen him take batting practice now for about 3 weeks. But I don't know what the issue is. Obviously, he's not prepared to go out on the rehab. But, you know, this team has been interesting. I think, you know, Stephen, this is one thing I think that's changed over the history of the game. In the past, when a player was injured, he was away from the team. Mm. And you went, you got healthy, and you came back. And now these injured players, most of them stay with the team, travel around, go through the workouts. But I think they would have been better off having him go down to Dunedin, work out down in Dunedin, get ready, and when he was ready. Because it's lonely when you're by yourself.
you mean it's might be a motivator, is what you're saying here, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's I kind of like that approach as well, Buck. Yeah, look, it's you're right. I mean, this team has injuries, obviously, but Buck, the two that I keep kind of wanting answers for, obviously, George Springer's one of them. And I'd like to know something about Ryan Borucki, too, because I swear to God, I think Ryan Borucki, again, if he's healthy, he's exactly what this team needs. I thought going into the year, I was telling people that if you're looking for somebody who's going to be important in the bullpen, yeah, Romano's going to be pitching in high leverage situations and all this stuff. But I just thought Borucki could be the guy. And Buck, I don't even know where he is. Do you have any idea where he is in his rehab?
As far as I know, he's still not throwing. And he's been out retroactively since the 11th of May. And, you know, given his history of his arm issues, remember he had Tommy John right off the bat in his pro career. And then he had chips removed, and he's had a couple of different surgeries on his elbow. So given his history, this is concerning. I agree with what Steven said, and I agree with what you believed about Borucki, a very important part of this team. And he was off to a very good start. He'd allowed just 7 hits and 13 and a third. and, you know, had struck out 14. So it looked like he had found his niche on his team working out of the bullpen. But it's very concerning. And you know what? At this point in the season, when you miss that much time, it's going to take as much time as you've been out to rehab to get ready to come back. So I think, he's probably a middle to late July guy at this point.
Now, look, and I know, and I'm just going to qualify this by saying, look, I know an organization, they don't have a responsibility to tell us everything, you know, every medical detail about their personnel. That's just true. Whether we're your fans or the press, we don't get full disclosure. But do you think, Buck, that communication is a bit of an issue here? Like, I was just thinking about Borucki and the different things I have heard Blue Jays people say about Ryan Borucki over the last month. And Blair, you can verify this. Like, we had Ross on one day, and he made it. You know, we had thought it was pretty dire because of the history you just alluded to, and you hear forearm tightness, and you think Tommy John or elbow at very least. And then I think Ross came on, and he said, no, it's – and made it sound – almost that his return was imminent, but yep. That was what, 2 weeks ago, Jeff, something like that.
Yes, at least.
And in the meantime, you hear people say, no, this is not good, but you know, like obviously he's hasn't been sent off to see Dr. Andrews or anything as far as I know. But do you think, and then we just talked about the Springer situation. Do you think there's a communication problem here?
You know what, Stephen, that's a great question, but I don't know what the responsibility of the club is, whether or not they have any obligations to tell us everything. You know, and I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that we don't know about. But, you know, you talk about Borucki, and that's kind of baffling. We haven't heard more updates or this is what he's doing. And, you know, in Charlie's defense, I'm sure that he's more concerned about the 26 guys that are here than he is about anybody else that's rehabbing, because as a manager – and I can speak from experience, if you're not healthy, you can't help me. So I don't know why I'm knowing an awful lot about you. And I want to hear the trainer come in and say, okay, this guy's good to go. He'll be here tomorrow. But it's the same for Thomas Hatch, who's had a setback, and you know his injury is kind of a mystery. Julian Merriweather. When's the last time we had any information about Julian Merriweather? But once again, I must state, and having been on the other side, I didn't want to tell everybody everything that was going on because it has an impact on several fronts, including your ability to make a trade. So if everybody in baseball knows you've got all of these major injuries of guys that you hope to have come back and maybe they're not going to come back, all of a sudden the price of a trade goes up dramatically. So I don't think the ball club's under any obligation to share information with the media or the public, especially when it becomes an injury concern because – and it's just like Charlie being his Zoom calls. He said, you know, somebody will say, well, what's the limit for this guy tonight? Well, I'm not going to tell you that because that's something that's universal to us. We need to know what it is, but the other team doesn't. And they're going to listen to all this information as well. So, you know, it's a very interesting question. Yeah, you'd like to believe that they're going to give you all the information that they can and they have. But at the same time, they're not going to give you information that's going to jeopardize their ability to pick up a player, make a trade, make a waiver claim, or anything like that, because it's all going to impact the other teams.
Buck, what are you expecting from Ross Stripling in this series? And, you know, we've talked a lot, and you guys talked about in the telecast, certainly the changes he has made to his delivery, the windup and some of the other things he's done. What are you expecting from him against this Astros team?
Jeff, I don't think there's any reason not to expect what we have seen from him the last two times. The positive changes in the adjustment have been dramatic. He's thrown 12 innings and given up 4 hits, and he's only walked 3 and struck out 10. I mean, for me, there's no reason to believe that that's going to change dramatically. You know, he pitched against Houston back on the 7th of May and down at Minute Maid Park and lasted only 3 2/3 and gave up 3 runs, a home run. He walked 3 and struck out 3. But he's a different pitcher than they saw before. And I like the fact that he went back to the delivery. And you guys have been around a long time, and you remember the Dodgers. When the Dodgers developed pitchers, they all had a classic windup. They all threw high fastballs and overhand curves. And Ross Stripling is the epitome of that. He's got a great windup. And for some reason, he went back to that abbreviated windup, even pitching out of the stretch as a starter. Well, that creates a Iron Mike kind of image for hitters. there's not a lot of movement. All you got to do is focus on the baseball, and you will see it very well. And the numbers suggested that. So now that he is hiding the ball a little better with his windup, he tucks it against his belt. He kicks his leg up high, and it's hard to pick up where the baseball is coming from. And because of that, he shut down a real hot Tampa Bay team in relief down in Dunedin the other day. And then now he's backed it up with another good outing against Cleveland. So I don't think that we should expect anything dramatically different than his last two outings.
Well, you know, and if he could settle into that four spot, Buck, it would solve a lot of, you know, it would solve a problem, right? And if you could just kind of get something consistent from anything like you've had in those last two appearances, that would answer a lot of questions. Speaking of the rotation, I do want to ask you with a little bit of distance now, when we look at those two Alek Manoah starts, you know, the first one was thrilling, and he was cranked up in a big stage, and he pitched better than you would have expected. The second one, he looked a lot more like a young pitcher who's going to have to figure it out in the major leagues when he doesn't have his best stuff. What do you think we get from him the third time around?
Well, I know, and you've heard me say this time and time again, how much I respect Pete Walker. But I think the biggest thing is what is going to happen is that he's going to realize he's got to repeat his delivery. And that's the most important thing. And the thing that he didn't do last time out, it was he was all over the place, and he couldn't make the adjustment to get the ball down in the zone where he wanted to. He did a very good job of that against the Yankees. And what was happening was his front side was opening up, his arm was dragging, and he missed a lot of arm side pitches. Ball got away from him. His slider wasn't very good. They never got to a point where they could incorporate the changeup in a consistent fashion. So I think this side session, he'll work an awful lot on repeating his delivery, working the ball down in the zone, because once you can command the ball down in the zone, you can elevate the pitch whenever you need to. But if you're not able to command it down in the zone, then you'll never be able to find the strike zone consistently. So I think that's what they're going to make a priority in his side session.
Buck, we all know how few professional innings he's thrown. We've talked about that, you know, in part because of the weird shortened season last year. But, you know, if this becomes, you know, he's obviously still in a developmental phase. Are you, from what you've seen of him, are you fine with him working on that stuff and working that stuff out in the big leagues right now?
Yes, I am, because of Pete Walker. I think if you have your top prospects and you have the ability, and they have a need, there's no question they have a need. I mean, if everything had worked well and if Pearson came out of spring training and took that starting spot, then Manoah would be down in AAA pitching and getting his innings in. But they have a need. He's mature. He's big and strong. He pitched at a high level in college, and you have your best coach in the organization working with him on a daily basis. Plus, he can sit and watch major league hitters. We saw his numbers in AAA. AAA is not even close to the major leagues now. So you can't really gauge what a pitcher does in AAA for what he's going to do in the major leagues. There's no barometer for saying, okay, well, he did that in AAA, he's going to do this in the big leagues. That's not the case at all. Because big league hitters don't swing at balls. They hit mistakes every time. And you have to be very, very command-oriented. But I think Manoah has all of these attributes, and I think at the time we're speaking of right now, he's in the best place he could be.
I want to shift focus a little bit, Buck, to stuff that came out of the owners' meeting yesterday, and probably not a surprise given what a lot of people were writing about a lot of the national writers going into the owners' meeting. But it appears as if Major League Baseball is going to it's going to follow up a little more on its, on looking at pitchers using foreign substances, frankly, than I thought they would. I thought this might be a systemic thing, and maybe it's something they talk about in the new CBA, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. How concerned are you about the fact that, well, two levels here. One, the use of foreign substances by pitchers and the impact that's having on spin rate and how that's contributing to low scores, et cetera, et cetera. But also, Buck, I don't know, but I'm not a fan of changing stuff in the middle of a season. I just think you're asking for trouble if you drop this on guys right now. Yeah, maybe I'm off base here. You've been in the game longer than I have. I just think it's almost punitive when you do it in season.
Well, and maybe it should be punitive. It's illegal, and that's the problem. And we have turned our backs on many things, including PEDs. And, you know, it lasted far longer than it should have, and it's probably still in the game somewhat. But if you watch a Major League game, I don't care what team, what league, when you watch it, every pitcher will go to his glove, the string on his glove, someplace on his uniform. Everyone does it, and it's everywhere. So, you know, I heard, and I talked to an umpire supervisor in the spring, and he said, yeah, we're going to take balls at random during the course of a game, and then we're going to inspect them, and then we're going to penalize and talk to the guys that we think are using stuff. Well, that's not happened, obviously, because guys are still using it. I can watch a game every single night and tell you who's using it and where he's getting it from. And it's just, it's rampant. It's universal. But there has to be something that you can say, okay, fellas, that's enough. The spin rates are ridiculous. Guys are throwing pitches they never had before. And it has to have an impact on it. There's no question about it.
Buck, we really appreciate you joining us. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, fellas. Enjoy the ball game tonight.
Thanks, Buck.
Absolutely. Take care. That's Buck Martinez, our Blue Jays voice on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. The first of a three-game series tonight between the Astros and the Jays. And
Blair, Steve, I was going to ask you, what do you the disclosure thing is an interesting question. Like, and again, I know. Like, look, you and I have covered, you know, certainly covered baseball, but it just covered all team sports for a long time. And there is kind of a, you know, all of them do it a little bit differently. Sometimes, you know, some of the disclosure, as in the National Football League, is about gambling. You know, the NHL made being opaque about injuries an art form, upper body, lower body, right? That's as far as they would go. But I think that there is, you know, there's kind of an art to being able to talk about this stuff, because you especially that, you know, we're in a weird time right now, right, where you're reaching your fans secondhand through Zoom calls.
Yeah.
But you know, confusion, like that, the confusion is understandable. When I hear, you know, Jays fans say, "What's really going on with these guys?" I understand the. I know why they're confused. I'm confused.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it. I look at this two ways. You can make the case that. Obviously, that there's a competitive element to this. You can make the case that as a consumer product, which this is, there is a certain, not an expectation, but there's kind of a, it would be nice to be as open with your consumers as possible about your product.
Yeah.
I know that sounds really silly, but that's...
No, that sounds right, actually.
And there has to be some middle ground. And what I really think has happened here, and I'm not calling anybody out here by any stretch of the imagination, but this is the type of stuff that you used to get as a writer by off-the-record sources, working the clubhouse, hanging out around the batting cage. I mean, I can see people rolling their eyes out there. In some cases, I can hear people rolling their eyes. But no, I could see people rolling their eyes out there. But trust me, this is where as a reporter, you're not gonna get anything really over Zoom call. Nobody's gonna. At no point is Charlie gonna go, "Guys, you caught me. Springer's done for the year." Hey, you know, he's not. That's not gonna happen.
Yeah,
it's the type of thing you need to get off the record. And then try to put the screws to somebody to get it on the record. And, you know, I think back to, I can't even remember what year it was. Kevin Pillar broke his hand, I believe it was in a game in Texas, punching the dugout wall. And it didn't come out for a month. And the only reason it came out is because one of the Blue Jays coaches was on Baseball Central, and I can't remember, it was Eric, I can't remember the last name, and talked about Kevin Pillar having a hand injury. And so a couple of us went and started looking around. Eventually, Kevin Pillar came and said, "Look, guys, it's embarrassing, but yeah, I broke my hand. I, you know, punched a wall and yada, yada." That's sometimes how stuff like that happens. That's sometimes what it takes
Yeah,
to get to the bottom of things. Well, now, it's possible that there are people out there, Steve. It's possible there are reporters out there who know what's going on with George Springer.
I doubt it.
But
in this situation, I doubt it. Cause, and sometimes it also emerges, I was going to say, sometimes it emerges as informed speculation, correct?
Correct. And this is now, and that's what I was getting to with this. I have been around Buck and Dan Shulman and Pat Tabler and Ben Wagner long enough to know that the organization trusts these guys enough that there is room for a relationship that would lead to informed speculation. We're not even getting that here.
No.
So I understand why people want it. I understand why the Blue Jays don't want to give it out. I understand why it hasn't emerged. I'm not surprised. I truly, truly believe that if reporters were on the scene, and again, I'm not calling anybody out here. Believe me, I'm just saying as someone who's dealt with this crap, this stuff for a long time, if reporters were on the scene, it would make a difference. Because believe me, what you are getting on a Zoom call is less than the bare bones. Much less than the bare bones you would get in a day of work at the ballpark.
Well, and the other part of that is, and Buck is right about this, it's not the field manager. The field manager's job is the 26 guys that he's
got. Exactly.
Yeah, so he's not, they do tell him stuff, and he's in meetings, and he hears things. But the field manager's job and focus is going to be the 26 guys that he has available to him, not the guys who are not available. So I get, it's not Charlie's job, really.
No. If a relationship develops enough with a manager, front office person, generally you find yourself in a position where you can go to the person and you can say, look, this is what I've heard. This is kind of where I'm leaning. I might want to write something on this. Am I going to look like an ass? It's to your benefit to nip this in the bud, basically, because it's a whole hell of a lot better for you to say, Jeff, you're off base. That isn't the case, as opposed to me writing something, then you guys having to put out fires for 48 hours. And this is something that people, I don't want to get into journalism 101, but players and executives who work to limit access to reporters, I get their argument, but there's a flip side here. And the flip side is, trust me, you're going to have to deal with way more BS. You know, go and talk to Jose Mourinho or Jurgen Klopp about the crap they have to put up with because reporters don't have access to their players. So-and-so's pissed off at the coach. So-and-so's got a serious injury. There's a real balancing act here. There's the possibility of too much information being given out, but there's also a chance of a crap storm emerging that takes 48 hours to put out. Nobody really needs that. Yeah, that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting discussion in this moment. And again, from a fan point of view, if you're frustrated because you don't know what's going on, I understand why you're frustrated. Yeah. There's probably some people covering the team that feel the same way.
Yeah, just imagine people have to talk about it on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
How do you structure what you say? And again, it's entirely possible that I think Buck's probably given this come the closest to this as you can. I think we're at the stage now with George Springer where it's George Springer's call. Dude, you want to play tonight? You tell us.
Mm-hmm.
And having said that, of course, I immediately am getting folks on the text line talking about the high performance department. So that is there's a whole other aspect. And that is one thing I will say very quickly. Last thing before we break and bring Kyle Bukauskas in. There is another layer of management now in sports.
True. Not just the trainer.
Not just the trainer. Not just, it used to be trainer, manager, pitching coach. They kind of work stuff out. And then you found out now there's a high performance department. And it's a big department. It's bigger than the coaching staff. So now you've got another layer of management, another layer that information has to go through. And I think that's also a complicating factor here. The Jets and the Montreal Canadiens will play the second game of their series tonight in Winnipeg. Kyle Bukauskas is Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada's ringside reporter. He'll join us next. This is Writer's Block. All right, the Blue Jays lineup is in for tonight's game. It'll be Semien Bichette, Guerrero in first base, Teoscar in right, Randall Grichuk in center, Joe Panik is back at third, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. in left, Roddy Tellez is DHing, Danny Jansen behind the plate, Hyunjin Ryu on the mound for the Blue Jays. 7:07 first pitch from Salem Field. They will be taking on the Astros and Zach Greinke. That'll be about half an hour before puck drop in Winnipeg, where the Montreal Canadiens will take on the Winnipeg Jets in the second game of that series. Of course, it is the first game since Mark Scheifele's hit on Jake Evans, and the first game since Mark Scheifele was suspended for 4 days as a result of that hit. He did his media availability today in Winnipeg, said he was not going to appeal the suspension, which I don't know if many people thought he would. I thought he showed appropriate contrition. People who know Mark Scheifele would tell you that that's what he said was probably very much in character, or was very much in character for him. Let's bring in Kyle Bukauskas. He's a ringside host and reporter with Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. Kyle, thank you for joining us. So just a general question. What is the mood around there now? And did we know Mark Scheifele's not going to be playing in the game, but did what he say maybe change the tone at all of the discussion as far as the Montreal Canadiens are concerned? Because as Ren Lavoie pointed out yesterday, there were a lot of hard feelings between those two teams after that hit.
Yeah, it's a great question, Jeff. And, for me, just early on in the series here, I'm kind of watching from afar like the rest of us when Scott Oak is doing his thing in Winnipeg, and I'll pick it up when it shifts to Montreal here on the weekend. But, one thing I thought was interesting, Scott Oak had the interview with Brendan Gallagher at the end of that game, and he brought up the fact that, I know Mark Scheifele. He knows better than that. And Scheifele was asked about that by our colleague Sean Reynolds this morning, and Scheifele said, him and Gallagher talked yesterday. He obviously shared where he was coming from and how he viewed things, tried to reach out and make sure that Jake Evans was doing all right and made a point to that. So I bet that probably did play a factor. Now, if we get to a game six in this series, is he going to have to answer for it? Probably, because that's kind of where we still are at with the sport. But, when you heard from whether it was Tyler Toffoli or Dom Ducharme or Shea Weber, the captain this morning, it's all, hey, we're beyond this now, and we've got a game two to worry about here to try to steal another one and come home with a 2-0 lead. So I believe, the players certainly, they've got Jake Evans on their mind and they care about the health of their teammate, but I believe they've done a good job here in turning the page and making sure mentally they're in the right headspace here for a massive game here tonight in Winnipeg and, game two of this series.
Well, and the other thing, Kyle, they're a team that's won 4 playoff games in a row, right? I would think they would want to do everything to be in exactly the same frame of mind they were before the last, few seconds of that game, before the hit, because it's working, right? It's absolutely working for them.
Yeah, and what's amazing, Stephen, this team didn't win more than 3 games in a row throughout the entire 56-game regular season, and now they've won 4 in a row here in the playoffs. I think this team has shown all of us a lot here, right? And certainly Winnipeg's done their part and, taking down Edmonton the way that they did. But, I just look, it's been a difficult year for everybody. It was a tough year for them, not only under the condensed schedule, but then they had that weak COVID break and the number that's been thrown around a lot, 25 games in 44 days to finish off the regular season, the injuries that accrued over that time. You get into the playoffs, you're down 3-1 to Toronto. Like, it seemed like they had every excuse to just go, we'll try again next year. This just isn't working for us anymore. But they didn't. They battled back, and now they're in a great spot here against Winnipeg in the second round of the postseason. And you're seeing, remember when Mark Bergevin stepped to the podium there at the start of the year and said things like, we mean business, and we can play any way you want to play, which you haven't seen him say at the start of a season in a long, long time at the helm there in Montreal. And now we're finally seeing the benefits of that, are finally seeing what he meant. This is a team that looks like they mean business, and they fully earned the series over Toronto. And whether it's the being in the right headspace each game and just the confidence they have playing in front of Carey Price and how he's going right now, they're in a really great spot after a very, very trying regular season for them.
Kyle, how's this changed? There's always a pretty vigorous conversation in Montreal. That's an understatement around the team. But And I look, I don't like the chances whoever wins this series going in against whoever wins Colorado Vegas. I think that's going to be a bit of a speed bump. But if, you know, they've won a round as a huge underdog. They were up 1-0 in the second round. And, you know, especially with the young players kind of coming to the fore, like, how has that changed the fan conversation about where the Habs are right now?
Well, a lot, right? Because down 3-1 to Toronto, it was, you know, Bergevin's gone, Ducharme's gone, you know, trade this guy, trade that guy, right? It's such a, certainly in the playoffs, as you know, like, you're living and dying after each game. You're feeling as a fan about your team completely changes. But, you know, we're seeing there's been a lot of lineup decisions that Ducharme has made throughout these playoffs that a lot of people haven't agreed with, but it's worked. Eric Gustafson being one of them, mm-hmm. putting him into the lineup. The fact that Alexander Romanov hasn't played, the fact that, you know, Kotkaniemi was scratched the first game, Caulfield was scratched the first two games, that they weren't in right off the jump here in the postseason. You know, they've faced a lot of heat here along the way, and the emotions have changed. Kind of they've rode the waves of these playoffs here so far. But now you're back to seeing the excitement, right? Like we saw the scenes out front of the Bell Center there for game seven as they were going up 1-0, 2-0. And obviously, you know, 2,500 in the building for game six, and being able to do that again for games three and four here. I think, like the players, they're seeing the confidence that the group has, again, playing in front of Carey. And now with the young players coming in here now, you know, Kotkaniemi's all of a sudden up to four goals. Suzuki's on a four-game goal streak or point streak. And beyond that, I mean, even some of the older guys, too, the effectiveness of Corey Perry and, you know, Eric Staal, who fell under a lot of criticism towards the end of the regular season, right? Had the overtime winner in his debut with the Canadiens and didn't do a whole heck of a lot the rest of the way for the final stretch of the season before the playoffs. Now he's got 6 points in seven games. So the fact that they're getting contributions from different players that I think came under fire at certain points in the regular season, and, you know, the coach, though, going against the wisdom of the fan base a lot of times when it comes to putting together his lineup, you know, it's working for him right now. I mean, who the heck knows what's going to happen here tonight, but certainly the narrative has changed from where it was, you know, 8-9 days ago, for sure.
Kyle, tactically, what have we learned about Dominic Ducharme throughout these playoffs? Because you're right, he was questioned, and I think fairly so for some of his lineup decisions. But then, you know, once the Canadians started winning, it was all about Carey Price, and you know, the focus turned on the players. And I'm sure, frankly, Dom Ducharme is probably saying, that's fine, keep the focus on the players. But what have we learned about him tactically as a coach? Because surely he gets some sort of, you know, if we're throwing Sheldon Keefe's coaching under the microscope, and that's fair game, certainly we also have to give Dom Ducharme some credit here, don't we?
I believe so. And again, I think that comes down to, you know, first off, how he's selecting his 20 guys each night, because that's been questioned a lot, and he's stuck to his guns. And as he said, you know, he realized when he got hired for the job, first off, he was going to have, you know, 8 million assistant coaches right there along with him. So I think, you know, that is obviously a factor. One of the things that was talked about a lot, certainly heading into the series against Toronto and through the first few games where they only had, you know, four goals through the first four, just the amount of shots that came from the outside and the structure that they were playing wasn't necessarily setting them up for a lot of more of the higher danger type opportunities, or at least generating some offense from the spots on the ice that you traditionally will score from. But now, you know, you're seeing a little bit more effectiveness there. They've, between him and Alex Burrows, the power play has been an adventure at times, but now it's, you know, come through in the last three games in a row here. So there's some momentum and some good things to build off here. I mean, I think this is a coach that, you know, I, as much as it's part of the new wave of coaches, and that he is a younger guy. I still, you know, it's not certainly the John Cooper type where, you know, it's a little more high tempo, high pace, or the Sheldon Keith puck possession. The big thing he always comes back to is, you know, we're always moving as a group of five. And, you know, I talked about how busy their schedule was down the stretch. And I think over those final 44 days, they had, you know, five, maybe six full days of practice in that time. And, you know, as a new coach, that's not a lot of time to implement, you know, what you want to have set in place for your players. So, you know, having that week off in between the regular season and the start of the playoffs was clearly a big, big boon for him and his staff. And, you know, now I just think that, you know, this is a coach that is willing to adapt on the fly. And he has tweaked his lineup, but also isn't afraid to stick to his guns, even though you may have, you know, screams from many different corners yelling for you to make a change. He's confident in what he believes in. Sorry.
Does he have to win this series to secure the job for next year, or is he playing with house money now?
I don't. That's a great question. I thought about that a lot, just because, I mean, go back to, again, what Bergevin said at the start of the year. Like, this was no longer about a team that, let's just try to get into the playoffs and then anything can happen when you do get there. It's clear from the outset the expectations were this was a team capable of going deep and building on a little bit of success they had last summer in the bubble in Toronto. So I think the fact that, you know, they were able to turn around a series and win one, you know, the fashion they did against Toronto certainly do a big benefit here from them. And I believe there's potential. I think just because the question for me is, you know, what does the future of Mark Bergevin ultimately end up being once this season is done, regardless of how the year finishes? I think, you know, that question has to be answered here first. And if he's going to remain at the helm here moving forward in Montreal, and I believe, you know, again, regardless of how the team ends up finishing here in the playoffs, that will likely go a long way towards determining what Ducharme's future is.
Kyle, really good of you to do this today. Thanks so much.
Okay, great chat with both of you. Take care.
Have a great weekend. That's Kyle Bukauskas, ringside host and reporter with Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. And, Dominic Ducharme, you know, weird things happen when Canadians coaches win Stanley Cups. You know, the history of that team, there's always been something kind of odd at different points in time surrounding, you know, whether you go back to Al McNeil and all that stuff. And I know they're different. It's a completely different situation than with Dom Ducharme. But, you know, honest to God, Stephen, if he gets these guys through, why wouldn't you bring him back?
No, I think,
if you're going to bring Mark Bergevin back, why wouldn't you bring this guy back?
Well, and if he wins this series, like that, I'd say that's, I guess that'll cinch it. But yeah, I think if Bergevin's back, Ducharme's probably back now. And boy, I was thinking about Montreal, Jeff, and you know it well. This time of year, city's opening up. They're letting people go to the hockey games. They're in the second round of the playoffs and they're ahead. They're looking really good to go to a third round. This might kind of feel like, you know, and they're going to cut a deal with the Canadian government, I think, to allow those games to be played in Canada in the third round. Those are the ingredients for that. I'd like to move there is what I'm saying for a couple of weeks. Because there's nothing better, man. There's nothing better.
For a couple of weeks, make sure that for taxation purposes, yes, your residence is here.
Yes, true.
I mean, for me, it doesn't matter. But, Brent, for you, we're talking a couple of $100,000.
Oh, it'd be enormous. That's right.
We will take a break and come back and get you set for Tim and Friends. It's Writer's Block. All right, Kelly Rudy, Dan Shulman, Chris Johnson, Ren Lavoie joining Tim and Friends, as will Kenny Smith. Mr. Brent, we bid adieu to LeBron James in the playoffs last night.
Mm-hmm.
Could be saying goodbye to Kawhi Leonard and the Clippers.
They have.
Is my Schadenfreude showing a little bit there, do you think?
Well, the Lakers did win it last year, so it's...
Yeah, I was thinking more of Kawhi.
But the Kawhi thing, oh yeah, I think there's a fair bit of that going on right now, isn't there? They've got that's an uphill battle against that team they're playing, man, against Dallas. Kawhi has a big... But that, you know, that team has never, Jeff... have you ever seen that Clippers team look like it was supposed to look since he got there? I'm not saying it's his fault entirely, but it never really came together, did it?
No, you never got the sense that it was... I wouldn't say you never got... There was an odd sort of smugness about it for a team that really has won jack.
Yep.
If you watch them play in the court, it was almost a too cool for school aspect to that team. And... I don't know. Look, I certainly don't begrudge Kawhi. I think we'll never know some of the intricacies of that move. I see the evil hand of Uncle Dennis all over that. And, you know, I give Masiah Ujiri credit. I think he's, you know, he sort of held his fire in that regard. But, yeah, I don't feel bad for Kawhi. It's odd. Maybe that says, maybe that kind of says something about the Clippers. Like, I don't feel bad for him. I can't say that I'm extremely happy either. Yeah, I just don't. I just kind of have no feeling, because at no point, honest to God, did I look at the Clippers and think they're going to win.
Well,
like, there's something not right there.
It's hard to feel really grouchy about a guy who did come to your team and deliver a memory for your entire lifetime. So, like, it's not like he was a guy who left without the rings. So, we'll always have Paris, right?
Yeah, I think he and Uncle Dennis played us a little bit, though.
Maybe. Anyway, changing of the guard, you're in the NBA, though.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, my real regret in this is I love watching Portland play, and I love Damian Lillard, and I really wish they were still around here, because they're such a fun team. They're such a fun team to watch, and that's kind of my one regret here. I don't know. I don't really have any.
You can root against Brooklyn. Hard to root against Steve Nash, but it's not hard to root against Brooklyn.
Yeah, I have a hard time working up a hatred about them either. I kind of don't care who wins right now. It's odd, because usually I've got like one fallback team that I can cheer for, that I can care about. Mr. Brunt, thank you for doing this.
Already.
Big baseball series this weekend, 3 against the Astros in Buffalo, and of course tonight, Montreal and Winnipeg, game 2 at 7:30. Colorado and Vegas, game 3 of that series is at 10 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll chat with you Monday. Tim and Friends are next.